So what recourse do the states and the people have when the federal government oversteps its enumerated powers? We'll try to answer that question next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, and I'm the Executive Director of Camp American. And usually, my good friend Barry Sheets, the Director of the Institute for Principled Policy, is the host of this show, but he is very involved in a campaign that he's a consultant for, and this being the weekend before the general primary election in Ohio, he is very busy. He has a candidate who is doing very well, and the more work they put in it on this end, the closer they'll be on Tuesday to getting the job done, getting his candidate elected. So I will be running solo on this program. Hopefully next week, Barry will be back. We'll see. In any case, we give thanks for your prayers for him throughout this campaign season. And Barry, I know, is very grateful for your prayer support. So if you could continue to do that, that would be fine as well. Today, we're going to talk about a subject. And in fact, the lecturer today is Barry Sheets. So you do get to hear his voice. In 2012, Barry gave a presentation on the principles of 98 at Camp American. First of all, I want to give you the opportunity to find out what Camp American is all about. I would invite you to go to campamerican.com. That's campamerican.com. Don't go to campamerica.com. If you go to campamerica.com, you'll be able to buy some very nice camping supplies, I understand. But the camping supplies are good if you want to come to camp. But in order to find out what we're about, you need to go to campamerican.com. And what you'll find out there is our program for this year, who we've got speaking, what the dates are, and the dates are June 16th through the 21st. That's June 16th through the 21st, 2014. And we would invite you to come up to camp, send your children between the ages of 12 and up. And if you have no children, you are also invited to attend as a camper. I will warn you that the facilities are, shall we say, rustic. They are cabins, and there is a small amount of electricity available, very small amount. There's communal showers for men and communal showers for women. They're in separate bathhouse, so there's no showers in the cabins or anything like that. Just so you know that it is a kind of a rustic camp setting, so there's no surprises. And if you don't want to do that, if you're an adult and you want to stay off campus, there's no reason why you can't stay off campus in one of the many, many hotels. We're right on a resort lake. We're set on Lake James in Angola, Indiana. And there are lots of fine hotels in the area. There are lots of good restaurants in the area. There are lots of things to do in the area, which is one of the reasons we love having camp at Pokagon State Park Group Camp, which is where Camp American is located. And if you don't know where that is, that's in the northeast corner of Indiana, right about 5 miles from the Michigan border and about 10 miles from the Ohio border. So it's right up there in the corner. And it's very easy to get to. Go to Fort Wayne, Indiana, go straight north on I-69, and there's an exit right off I-69 that gets you virtually right into the state park where we're located. So keep that in mind. Now, that being said, Barry Sheets gave this presentation on the principles of 98. Now, what are the principles of 98? Well, it's important to understand that what we're talking about really, when we talk about the principles of 98, is the doctrine of the enumerated powers and the limitations of the federal powers and the what it says in Amendment 10. And Amendment 10 to the United States Constitution is a very important concept. And just so you understand what we're going to be talking about, what Barry's going to be talking about, I'm going to read it for you. Here's Article 10. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, what does that mean? Well, what that means is that there are a number of powers that are set aside for the federal government. Now, those are called the enumerated powers. And where are the enumerated powers outlined? Well, that's very simple. Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 8, and in some cases Sections 9 and 10. But Article 1, Section 8 is the main enumerated powers, and that is where all the powers that are reserved to the federal government alone are located. And actually, it's a very limited set of powers. It doesn't include things like health care, like mandatory and government-controlled retirement insurance. It doesn't include whether or not you can buy incandescent light bulbs. Of course, there were no light bulbs in 1787 when the Constitution was written. But to cover that, you don't need a constitutional amendment. You need to think about it in terms of what powers are handed over to the federal government. And light bulbs would not have been one of them had this been written in the year 2014, I will assure you. There are all kinds of things that are allowed. They can borrow money. They can regulate commerce with foreign nations. They have the power to lay and collect certain kinds of taxes for the revenue of the United States. In fact, that's why we have the Constitution. So basically, so the federal government could have some revenue, because under the Articles of Confederation, it really didn't have a consistent source of income. They can set naturalization and immigration laws, something we are dealing with in the Congress, and we're not dealing with it very well, but nonetheless, that is a federal responsibility. They can coin money and regulate the value. Well, is that being done in Congress these days and by the federal government? Well, some people think it is, but of course, the Federal Reserve System, which really is doing that job at the moment, is not a government agency. It's what's known as a quasi-government agency. It is really a private corporation. It is controlled by a number of large banks, and not by the Congress of the United States, even though the president does get to appoint the head of the Federal Reserve System. The Congress appoints that head from a list provided by the banks. So it's really a hand-in-glove operation. They can punish counterfeiting. They can establish post offices. They can promote progress of science and useful arts by giving out patents and copyrights. So the federal government has the right over patents and copyrights. They can declare war. They can constitute courts inferior to the Supreme Court. In other words, the Supreme Court is a constitutional creation, but the inferior courts, like the federal circuits, the federal district courts, and administrative courts, are completely a creation of Congress. They can raise and support armies. They can provide a navy, make rules for government, call forth the militia. There are a number of things, and if you look at those are all basically have to do with the doctrine of DDT, when Barry and I teach our Institute on the Constitution class. DDT stands for Defense, Diplomacy, and Trade. Congress and the president have the power over defense, diplomacy, and trade. Those are restricted to the federal government. And that list I gave you is very short. Everything else is left to the states. So one of the problems we're running into is the fact that the states have overstepped their bounds. And that's what the 10th Amendment is about. Now, I'm going to read for you something that's kind of important in this debate, and that is a forgotten document, or mostly forgotten document. A lot of people don't know that the first 10 amendments to the Constitution have a preamble, just like the Constitution. And here's what the preamble says. The conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. Restrictive clauses. This is a sidebar. Restrictive clauses. Restricting what? Federal power. And as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution. That's part of the preamble. I'm not going to read the whole thing. That's the part that matters. The purpose of the Bill of Rights was to further restrict federal power and make those powers clear. So when the federal government usurps power away from the states or from the people regarding things like decisions over health care and what kind of light bulbs you can use and what kind of ladders you can use in your house and any number of things, is a complete usurpation and violation of the 10th Amendment. So what recourse do the states have? What steps can they take when the federal government oversteps those bounds? Well, that's the question. That's the question that Barry attempts to answer. And this is actually a two-parter. We're going to play the first part now, and we'll play the second part in a subsequent week. But this is the kind of class that you would get at Camp American. And we invite you to come up to Camp American and see what we're all about. And you can get this kind of education, not just for you, but for your children. And I think you'll find that this is a very useful thing. The principles of 98 are based on what are known as the Kentucky Resolves and the Virginia Resolves. And these are the documents written by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in 1798 in response to the Alien and Sedition Acts that were congressional usurpations of state authority and very similar to today's Patriot Act. And these were responses that were written to the Alien and Sedition Acts, in which the doctrine of nullification is outlined. I know that's a bad word to a lot of people. All I can say is too bad. I've gone a little further into detail than I meant to. This is about a 42-minute presentation, so I'm going to go right to it. Here is Barry Sheets with the Principles of 98.
Good morning, campers. Hey, that's pretty good for first thing on a Monday. I think we've got, for a small group, we've got a great volume in here. That's great. Well, I'm Barry Sheets. I'm the executive director of the Institute for Principled Policy. We're a nonprofit that works toward bringing biblically based solutions to public policy issues. Also, teach here at camp, and for the next 2 hours, we're going to be looking at a topic that is not widely known. Some of the aspects of it are, but the topic itself is really not talked about much these days, and you certainly won't hear it out of the major media or from any other what we call standard news source. But what we're going to be talking about today is the principles of 98, and we'll talk about what that means here in a minute. But we're going to start off with a scenario this morning. Well, first of all, I want to make sure that everybody has with you, you got your notebook to take notes. You need a copy of your pocket constitutions, because we're going to be looking at those this morning. And if you do have your Bibles with you, why don't you go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Romans 13.
I'm not sure everybody got a pocket constitution.
Okay, is there anybody here who doesn't have a pocket copy of the Constitution that they can look at? Did any of the campers or anybody else? Okay, we got a couple people who didn't, Chuck, who don't have a copy of the Constitution that you can look at. Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and get started then, but first we're going to read Romans 13, verses 1 through 7. Okay? And do I have a volunteer from the students, anybody who would like to read for us today? Okay, Webster, why don't you go ahead and do that. Read Romans 13, 1 through 7.
Okay. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God, and the powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive themselves condemnation. For magistrates are not to be feared for good works, but for evil. Wilt thou then be without fear of the power? Do well, so shalt thou have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thy will. But if thou do evil, fear, for he beareth not the sword for naught. For he is the minister of God to take vengeance on him that doeth evil. Wherefore ye must be subject, not because of wrath only, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause ye pay also tribute. They are God's ministers, applying themselves to the same thing. Give to all men, therefore, their duty, tribute to whom ye owe tribute, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom ye owe honor.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, now we're going to be thinking about, keep that in context as we're talking this morning, because it is important to remember specifically out of Romans 13 what the ruling authorities are called. Okay? But we're going to first start with a scenario. Okay, start of the scenario. The country is very tense after a series of incidents involving foreign agents. Okay? And on June 25th, Congress gives the president power to remove individuals deemed by him to be, quote, dangerous to the peace and safety of the United States, or of whom he has, quote, reasonable grounds to suspect of treasonable or secret plans against the government. Okay? Sound familiar? Now, Congress went on and says the president can also imprison such persons, quote, as long as he thinks the public safety requires it. Okay? In other words, what we're talking about is indefinite incarceration. In other words, they can put you in jail and throw away the key until the president decides you're not a threat anymore. Now, the president can also grant a license to you to stay in the country at such a place as he may designate, so he can tell you where you have to be, or in which can be revoked by the president whenever he shall think proper. In other words, if he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed the next morning, he could say, well, you know, Blaine, you know, that license I gave you, I'm taking it back now and we're throwing you in jail. Now, that's kind of a frightening scenario, isn't it? Now, the question is, well, before we ask the question, there's more to it. It isn't just this. Now, Congress also passes a law to restrict the exercise of the rights under the First Amendment. And they now made it unlawful to combine together, that means to get in a group, to oppose any measure or measures of the government of the United States. Okay? Bye-bye tea parties, right? Or to impede the operation of any law of the United States. In other words, you can't fight back against what Congress tells you is law, including this law. You can't write, print, or publish any, quote, false or malicious or scandalous writings against the government. And who decides what false, malicious, and scandalous mean in context, in this context?
The government
does. They determine what's false, malicious, or scandalous. Now, all violations of these provisions come with fines of up to $5,000 and jail time of anywhere from 6 months to 5 years in prison for violating these acts. Okay? Okay, now comes the quiz. Which president has been given such sweeping powers in order to protect against terror? Anybody want to make a guess? Yes. Barack Obama. Okay. Well, not quite. Not quite. And we'll be talking a little bit later in the second hour about some of the things that Congress is doing that may be heading that direction with Barack Obama as president wanting them done. But who we have was John Adams, the second president of the United States. He was the president who was giving those sweeping powers. And remember I said on June 25th? Well, today is the 214th anniversary of the passage of what's called the Alien Act. And it was followed a month later by the Sedition Act, and we're going to be talking about both of those, the Alien and Sedition Acts. But basically, John Adams, who was the second president, was part of the Federalist Party. And we're going to talk about the differences between the Federalists and their opponents later. This thing is touch response. And the problem that they had were, at that point in time, they were just coming out of some issues relating to the French Revolution. Now, has anybody studied the French Revolution? Michael, I figured you had. But some of the students, have anybody ever studied the French Revolution? Okay, we've had some kids who've studied that. We know that the French Revolution ended up becoming chaos because they threw off, first of all, God's law, and then they replaced it with basically whatever works for the directorate or the powers that be. They could pass whatever law they want to, send people to the guillotine, imprison others, exile others, and do whatever they felt like. There were also some issues that were going on as far as the relationship between France and the United States. And if you remember your history a little bit, France was an ally of the United States during the American War for Independence. But as we're developing a constitution based upon God's law and the rule of law, they're devolving into chaos by going strictly with humanistic, atheistic laws developed by men. It was what was called the Terror. At the time in France. And so there was a lot of tension in the United States over France because there were some who saw what was going on in France and were fearful of it happening in the United States. There were some who, because France was our ally during the War for Independence, wanted to support France. And so you had tensions there as well over how we dealt with our foreign neighbors. Well, this touched pets. But we also had tensions at home. And we're going to talk about some of those tensions. Now, we're going up into 1790. So right after we wrote the Constitution, there were some tensions and continuing tensions. And some of those were political. Okay, why my touch pad's having a problem. One of those, obviously, was political, was party factions. Now, has anybody ever read Washington's Farewell Address? Okay, well, good. We've got some students who've read it. If you remember in Washington's farewell address, one of the things that he wrote strongly against was what he called the spirit of party or factions. He didn't believe political parties were good and healthy for the country. But yet, by the time we get to the second president, John Adams, we now have party factions. We have the Federalist Party and the Republican Party. And we're going to look at their history here in a little bit. So they were fighting against each other and had two very divergent views of how the country should be managed. And those were brought out by the two leading men in these two parties, obviously John Adams, who was the president of the United States, and Thomas Jefferson, who had authored the Declaration of Independence, and who was probably the leading Republican of the day. And these two men did not see eye to eye on much at all. Man, you know what? I think I'm going to do that. Because the touchpad's having a little problem this morning. And so basically, after the writing of the Constitution in 1789, there were debates held over the ratification of the, because it had to go out to the states to be ratified. And so there were debates because there was a difference of viewpoint in relation to how this Constitution was written. And the two factions were obviously the Federalists, who we've talked about. Now, they believed in a very strong central government or a federal government and a very liberal construction of the powers granted under the Constitution. Okay? That's where they stood. That's where the Federalists stood. And they were in power because their guy, John Adams, was president at this time. Now, the Anti-Federalists, who later became the Republican Party, and I'm not talking about today's modern Republican Party, so let's not confuse the two. The early Republicans, or then became Democrat Republicans, which then became the Democratic Party, modern, and the Federalists then became the Whigs, which then became the Republican Party. So today's modern Republicans and Democrats actually kind of trace each other back in a cross position. Just so you keep that clear. So when I say Republicans, I'm talking about 18th century and going into the 19th century Republicans. So the Anti-Federalists feared a strong central government because they felt it would lead to a despotism. They felt that you would end up having just a autocratic rule of thumb by, well, at that point in time, the Federalists. And they also favored a strict constructionist view. How many of you ever heard the word strict construction? Original intent. Have you ever heard those phrases? Okay, good, good. Yeah, some people have heard them. Well, the anti-Federalists or the Republicans favored that strict construction view of the powers of the Constitution. And we'll talk a little bit more about what that means here in a minute. However, during these debates over the ratification of the Constitution, we had something that came out to give people assurance that things weren't as bad as the anti-Federalists were making them out to be. They were called the Federalist Papers. Anybody heard of the Federalist Papers? Okay, some have. Okay, good, good. We got a few here. Well, the Federalist Papers were written by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. Okay? All good Federalists at the time. Now, they were a series of letters and newspapers written to defend the adoption of the Constitution. There were 85 Federalist Papers written. By these three men, mostly by Madison and Hamilton. I think John Jay may have written two or three of all 85 of them, but Jay gets title credit for helping to write them. And basically, these were put in the newspaper specifically in the state of New York, because New York was a key to getting the Constitution ratified. If they could get it through the state of New York's ratification procedures, they felt like they could get it done and get the new Constitution in place. So it was very important. So these men wrote these letters. Now, I've heard one commentator say that these letters were written at a very low level, because it was to reach the farmers of New York. Because New York wasn't this huge, massive, bustling metropolis with all these major boroughs like we know now. It was more rural and more farm-oriented, so they were writing to farmers. Now, how many of you ever tried to read the Federalist Papers? Okay? Was it easy? Did you understand it very well? But remember, this was written to farmers of the day who probably didn't have more than an eighth grade education. Well, eighth grade education back then was almost equivalent to a college degree today. So it just shows you how far we've devolved in our educational process, that we have trouble reading. Now, Mr. Michaelis and I have actually worked on a project to analyze and compare the Federalist Papers with the Anti-Federalist writings of the time, that and put the two corresponding together and discuss how they're structured. And I'll tell you what, that was not an easy task, was it, Charles? It's hard even for some of us veterans who've been around this stuff for a while to read those papers. But basically what they got down to was that they were promised that the concerns of the anti-federalists were unfounded. That, you know, all these are just nightmare scenarios that the anti-federalists are putting out there, and everything's going to be just fine. And here, let us tell you how. And they talked about how, you know, the judiciary is supposed to be the weakest branch of the three branches of government. And there are so many other things that they talked about. And there was a promise, specifically, in Federalist number 45, and it was written by James Madison. And this is the promise that they gave. It says that the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. The former will be exercised principally on external objects as war, peace, negotiations, and foreign commerce. The powers reserved to the several states will extend to all the objects which, in the ordinary course of affairs, concern the lives, liberties, and properties of all the people, and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. Now, if you were sitting there at this time period and you were an anti-federalist like Thomas Jefferson or others, and you read this letter in the newspaper coming from James Madison, who arguably is the father of the Constitution, and whose notes are the most complete record of the debates during the Constitutional Convention, how would you feel? would you think, okay, this is good, maybe we're blowing this out of proportion, or would you think that, I don't think he's telling me the truth? How many think that this is a good response to the anti-federalist concerns to say, hey, this isn't what we're about. This, we believe that we're going to keep the federal government in a box. Anybody think that? Well, that's exactly what Madison was trying to do. He really was. He was basically trying to reassure people, because that was his viewpoint as the father of the Constitution, that that's how the thing was drafted. That's how the Constitution was put together. That's how it's supposed to operate. Okay? And there was even further assurances. Well, the anti-federalists continued to push for more security against the unchecked growth and power of the central government, because that's what they feared the most. They feared a runaway government. They feared despotism. Actually, some of them really feared what Alexander Hamilton wanted. Remember, Hamilton was one of the writers of the Federalists. That's probably the reason why they were a little hesitant to accept this. Hamilton wanted a monarchy. In the debates, he was promoting he wanted a king, just like England had. Alexander Hamilton was really enamored of England, and he wanted America to have a king. And so the anti-federalists were still unconvinced, let's put it that way. So the Bill of Rights was adopted. In around 1791, it was actually brought forth to the Continental Congress by James Madison. And it was to assuage the concerns in a more specific manner of the anti-federalists, and it provided for individual liberties and protections, more so than what the anti-federalists thought was or saw in the body of the Constitution itself. Now, guys, everybody get your pocket constitutions out, okay? And we're going to go into the Bill of Rights, or the amendments to the Constitution. Now, in my copy, it says Amendment 1, Amendment 2. In some of yours, it may say Article 1, Article 2. But it's the bill of the amendments to the Constitution that we're going to be looking at. Okay? Okay, everybody there? Now, Chuck, I don't know in the copy that you passed out to folks what page that's on. Excuse me? 33. So page 33, if you look at the amendments to the Constitution, can I have a volunteer who will read me amendment number 1? Okay. Yeah, well, we've got two different types out here that were some were passed out last night, some were passed out today. So, all right, so page 33 for the ones and for you, and page 51 for the other ones, the citizen handbooks or citizen rule books. So, okay, do I have a volunteer who will read me amendment 1? I'm sorry, your first name is? Luke. Okay, Luke, thank you. If you would please read the First Amendment. Okay. We're going to bring a microphone over to you so we can catch this on the audio. Thank you, Luke.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, who's not supposed to make a law? Everybody. Congress. Congress, the federal government, the federal Congress. They're not supposed to make a law. Now, you know, we know about the religion clauses, the establishment and the free exercise clauses, but it's the other clauses that we're most interested in today for our purposes. The abridging the freedom of speech. Does anybody want to know what abridging means? Does anybody know what the word abridging means? Yes. Limiting. That's right, or curtailing, or stopping you from having it. Okay? So Congress cannot make a law to abridge the freedom of speech. In other words, they can't muzzle you from speaking out. Okay? Or of the press. So they can't pass a law to say that only governmentally approved newspapers, television stations, blogs, radio stations can put forward news. And the only thing they can put forward is what the government tells them they can put forward. Now, there are a number of countries where that's true, where the government controls the press. But that's not the way it was supposed to be crafted in this country. Then the right of the people peaceably to assemble. So in other words, can we get together in groups like, Camp American? Do we have that? Can Congress pass a law and say that we ban Camp American? No, they can't. It's outside their powers. And to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So, let's say, Stephanie, you've got a problem. And you decide that the only way that problem can be solved is by a law to be passed. Anybody ever heard that? Said somebody, something happened, somebody says, well, there ought to be a law. You've heard that before. Well, government can't pass a law saying, you have no right to ask us to pass laws. You have the right to petition your government for redress of grievances. Okay? So if Stephanie writes that letter and her congressman sends her back and says, well, you're in violation of Title 27 of the Code, Section 2703, and it's a five-year imprisonment, and so report to the Federal Detention Center in Moundsville next week. Is it legitimate? No. No, of course not. It's not, because we have protections in the Bill of Rights. Okay, specifically to prevent Congress from doing things to the people. Now, how many folks in the Bill of Rights, how many amendments are there in the Bill of Rights? 10, thank you. There are 27 amendments to the Constitution, but the Bill of Rights is the first 10. Okay, would somebody please read me amendment number 10? Would you like to do that, young lady? I'm sorry, your name is? Brittany. Would you please read that for us as soon as Mr. Michaels gets the microphone over to you?
The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people.
Okay, so the 10th Amendment, let's break it down. Now, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, okay? What does that imply? If you read that, what does it tell you? Yes, Luke. That these are not all the powers. Well, that's part of it, but what does it tell you specifically? What can you infer from that phrase? That the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. It implies that there are certain powers delegated to the United States in this document. Okay? That there are certain things that are reserved to the federal government, period. They've got the power. Now, we keep going, it says, nor prohibited by it, and the it refers to the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states. So what does that tell us? Now, come on, I know it's Monday morning and everybody's still tired because it was a late night last night, but what does that tell us? What can we directly infer from that phrase? That this Constitution has a list of things that the states are barred from having power in. In other words, there are certain things that it sets up that the federal government does have power, and there are certain things that it sets up that that the states don't have power in. Okay? So, if those powers not delegated to the U.S. or prohibited by the Constitution to the states, they are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. Okay? And that's where that redress of grievances thing ties in as well at that end. But the point is, what this says, the 10th Amendment says clearly is, read your Constitution. Okay, that's what the framers of the Bill of Rights, and like I said, James Madison brought it forward in the Congress. Actually, it was mainly drafted by a man by the name of George Mason out of Virginia. And I do another class where we talk about the First Amendment and George Mason's crafting of that and the reasons why it's important. But that's not for today. But, so, in other words, this Bill of Rights are prohibitions against the overreach of Congress beyond their enumerated powers. Now, does anybody know what the word enumerated means? You're going to hear it a lot at Camp American, and hopefully you'll start hearing it more out in the mainstream media as these things are moving forward. Anybody know what enumerated powers means? Webster. Specifically stated, that's right, they're listed out. That's what enumerated means. It means it's specifically spelled out. So in other words, there are powers specifically spelled out in the Constitution. Well, now we're talking about an overreach. The Alien and Sedition Acts. You know, that scenario I gave you at the beginning of class is part of that overreach, because remember, 1789, the Constitution's adopted. 1791, the Bill of Rights, which says that Congress can't do all this stuff, is put in there because the Anti-Federalists were worried about a strong federal government deciding that they were going to trample the states. So we turn the dial up a few years. George Washington has now left office, and John Adams is now the president, and the Federalist Party, because now we have party factions, is now in control. And in June 25th of 1798, 214 years ago today, we pass the Alien Act. And the gives the president power to detain aliens in the United States and either deport them or grant them a revocable license to stay in the U.S. at his discretion. Okay? Now, by aliens, you know, we're not talking about illegals coming across the border. We're talking about French, British, German. I mean, all the representatives from other countries, including ambassadors. Okay? Anybody who's not a native-born citizen in this country is subject to this act at this point. Now, the president also has the sole power of judging whether a person poses a threat to the security of the country. Think about that carefully. The president, one man, has been given by Congress all this power to judge whether or not Blaine or Webster or Luke or Stephanie is a threat to this country. Do you guys pose a threat to security? How am I going to know that as president? How am I going to figure that out? Am I waiting until you guys like throw a bomb through a window of a government building and then take credit for it on TV? Well, no, of course not. Of course I'm not waiting that long. We're going to talk about what they were actually how they were actually moving this forward in a little bit. But then again, about a few months later, or not a few months, the next month, about 5 weeks later, Congress passes the Sedition Act. And that says that it's illegal to utter, which means to speak, or to publish, which means to write, quote, any false, scandalous, and malicious writing or writings against the government of the United States or the President of the United States with intent to defame, or to bring them into contempt or disrepute. Okay, now if the Sedition Act was still enforced today, we wouldn't be here. You wouldn't have Fox News. Rush Limbaugh would be in prison somewhere. Yeah, you would. You see what I'm saying? But you know, it would also work on the other side when you had so Air America would be off the air a lot sooner than they were. But wait, this was 1798. Seven years ago, didn't we just pass a Bill of Rights that says that Congress shall make no law infringing the freedom of speech or abridging the freedom of speech or freedom of the press or freedom to assemble or to petition the government for redress of grievances? What happened to the First Amendment? Well, the Sedition Act also federalized a common law concept called seditious libel. Well, and that was what really concerned. It wasn't so much the content of it. It was the fact that they were trying to federalize common law that got the states really concerned, because that's a huge overreach. That basically means that states just don't have any authority whatsoever anymore. The states don't exist anymore. If the federal government can federalize common law, there's no need for the states. And so the anti-federal, the Republicans by this time, were pretty concerned, because here's how it worked out. Elements of the Federalist faction, the opposing parties, used these laws to harass and intimidate their Republican opponents.
Surprise!
We're using a law to create a political issue. What did they do? They incited mobs to attack newspapers run by those sympathetic to the Republicans. And it actually caused, in many instances, especially in Philadelphia, it caused the publishers of the newspapers to have to go into hiding, because they feared for their lives. But the sedition laws were in effect, so those Republican newspapers were being seditious. The Federalist factions were also opening mail addressed to or from known Republicans and examining their correspondence. That's how, as president, I'm going to find out what Blaine or Webster or Stephanie or Luke or anybody else in this room would be doing, and what you're thinking and what you're writing to people. And are you violating the Sedition Act? Yes, Webster. Thank you for thinking ahead. Now we're in an electronic age where you're putting things on Facebook and you're blogging and you're sending texts and emails to your friends. And we've got Tea Party groups who are doing rallies and publishing. Wow, if we had a sedition law today, it wouldn't really be too difficult for a government who wanted to crack down on their opposition to be able to figure out who their opposition really was. Right? They'll just order the tapes from this camp and they've got me pegged. So that's how those acts were being used. Now, Thomas Jefferson, who was the leading Republican of the day, were concerned for their safety. They had legitimate reason to be concerned. And this is what he said. He says, "For my own part, I consider those laws as merely an experiment on the American mind to see how it will bear an avowed violation of the Constitution." Now, I like to stop there and think, if he doesn't think the Alien and Sedition Acts were an avowed violation of the Constitution now, as they were written, I mean, we just looked at it. It's a violation of the Bill of Rights. But, you know, he was being charitable. He says, if this goes down, in other words, if the public, the people allow this to stand, we shall immediately see attempted another act of Congress, declaring the president shall continue in office during life, much like supposedly our judges of the Supreme Court have, reserving to another occasion the transfer of succession to his heirs. Now, what's this starting to sound like? Monarchy, divine right of kings, the British model. Jefferson's nailing it on the head. He knows what's happening. This is Alexander Hamilton's dream being put in place piece by piece by piece by the Federalists. And the establishment of the Senate for life, in other words, the House of Lords, just like in Britain. Well, of course, any kind of an overreach usually elicits a response. And the responses were, first, the Kentucky Resolution. Now, it was written by Thomas Jefferson, although he wrote it anonymously. Anybody guess why? Can anybody guess why he didn't, get out there and sign his name to the bottom of the document, or go out with a press release saying, "Hey, I've just authored these resolutions and they're going to be put forth in Kentucky." And they were. But what the resolution did, it put forth the principle of limited enumerated powers of the federal government. In other words, he's restating the obvious. He's restating what we know in the Constitution. We're going to look in the Constitution in a minute to see what those powers are. Thank you. And the resolution also resolved that the Alien and Sedition Acts, being an unconstitutional exercise of power by the federal government, were void. See, in his letter, he was a little bit more charitable, but once he got to writing the resolution, he basically stated in no uncertain terms that those acts were unconstitutional. Okay? Now, before we go further on going further, the Kentucky resolution was passed by the Kentucky legislature. And it basically said these were unconstitutional, and so therefore, we, as in the state of Kentucky, are not going to allow them to be enforced in our boundaries. In other words, you can't harass newspapers, and you can't round up people you suspect of being terrorists or a threat to the country just on the whim of the president. It's not happening here. Now, we go a little bit further because the Virginia Resolution and the report for the next year in 1799 were also penned. But this time it was penned by somebody different. It was authored by James Madison. There's a joke among historians that there's three different Madisons. There is the Hamiltonian Madison, which is him writing in the Federalist Papers, and basically assuring everybody of the fact that a strong central government's okay because of all these checks and balances we put in. There's the Jeffersonian Madison, which is what we're seeing now in the as he's looked at this and seen the overreach that's happening. Madison kind of strayed away from the Federalist Party and basically became a Republican. But he admitted the authorship later. He just hid from it right now because he was still trying to fly under the radar. And then the historians say that there's the third and the worst Madison, which is the Madisonian Madison, because later on in his life, he basically goes and makes a muddle of everything in his writings and goes and he's all over the boards. You know, at one point, yeah, I think the Virginia Constitution is great. Well, no, I think we need to have the federal government and the states shouldn't have that kind of authority. So Madison was kind of all over the boards, but at this point in time, he'd gone into the Republican camp. Now, the Virginia Resolution was stronger than the Kentucky Resolution, and it laid down the following as the basic principles of true federalism. Now, folks, does anybody know what the word federalism means? Okay? Anybody in here who wants to take a guess? What does federalism mean? Yes. Right, well, it's basically the legitimate authority that's distributed among the levels of government. Now, you all know we have three branches of government, the legislative, executive, judicial. They each have their own enumerated powers. We also have levels of government. We have the federal government, we have state governments, we have local governments, and we also have city and municipal governments as well. But federalism means that they stay within their jurisdictional boundaries. That if it's reserved to the feds, the states don't try to do it, or the locals don't try to do it. But if the feds don't have the power to do it, the states and the locals do have the power to do it. And so we get an imbalance in the concept of federalism when the federal government tries to take over the states' legitimate responsibilities by going beyond their enumerated powers. But basically, these were some of the basic principles. Nullification of overreaching federal laws by the states. Now, in the next hour, we're going to talk about these concepts. So, nullification of the overreach of federal laws and interposition. Okay? Those are the things we're going to be talking about as we go into the next class. And I think, if I'm looking at it right, Jim, we're just about at the end. So, are there any questions on this part of it? Okay? I know I've been basically up here lecturing. In the next hour, we're going to have a little fun. So, if there are no questions right now, then I guess I'll turn it over to Mr. Hill, if he's...
Again, that was Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy, giving a speech at Camp American on the Principles of 98. Again, if you want to know more about the Principles of 98, we will be running a follow-up to this at some time in the near future. It's actually more of a workshop. What Barry gave you there was kind of a more or less a theoretical approach, the theory behind it and the writings behind it. And again, these are based on the Kentucky and Virginia resolves as written by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. And this is not something that Jefferson and Madison kind of popped up with, cut it out of whole cloth, kind of made it all up, as some opponents of the ideas of the principles of 98 would have it be perceived. But the fact is, they based it on the 10th Amendment. And as we went through at the beginning of the program, the 10th Amendment makes it clear that those powers not specifically enumerated, reserved to the federal government, are reserved to the states and the people respectively. Now, if you take our Institute on the Constitution class, and of course, we are always looking to form a new class if you'd like us to teach a 12-week Institute on the Constitution class, I would ask around and ask people who have taken it. I know a number of people in the WLRY listening area have taken this class. There are a number of classes being taught now, and there are a number of other classes that will be forming soon. But one of the things that we teach in there is all about the enumerated powers and what the 10th Amendment actually means. And one of the things we come up with when we talk about that is the fact that there have been some Supreme Court decisions based around Article 10, or what's known as the 10th Amendment, Article 10 of the Bill of Rights. And again, I'll read that. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, to show you how disingenuous the courts can get, very early on in the American Republic, John Marshall, who many people consider to be a great hero of the Constitution, I have a different opinion on that, issued a ruling on what the 10th Amendment meant. And he said because the wording was not that the powers not expressly delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states or reserved to the states respectively or to the people, then it really just didn't have the punch that the amendment that got passed would have had if it had had those words expressly. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I can tell you that that is disingenuous in the extreme. The fact is that the framers, especially the states, had the complete intention of restricting federal power to those enumerated in the Constitution, directly laid out. They didn't mean that it could be expanded through what's known as the elastic clause or the necessary and proper clause, or any of the other clauses, some of them even based on the idea that the preamble somehow gives the federal government some kind of extra power. The fact is that a preamble never gives any document and any kind of power. It is a philosophical statement. The general welfare clause is another one of those that exists both in the preamble and in Article 1, Section 8. You have to study what these words mean, and that's exactly what it is we do when we teach these Institute on the Constitution courses. So I would suggest that you sign up for the Institute on the Constitution course for a little local thing. And if you really want a kind of an in-depth seminar, like you just heard today, because this is really one of the more advanced classes, one of the, that the Institute on the Constitution would do, would be a more in-depth seminar. Basically, we recommend that you come up to Camp American, and again, June 16th through the 21st in 2014, we suggest you come up and stay with us for a week and sit through these classes. Again, you can find out more about them at www.campamerican.com. That's www.campamerican.com. And of course, you can find out more about the Institute for Principled Policy, and you can get to Camp American through the Institute for Principled Policy's website. And ours is principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. One word, principled policy. And again, we invite you to come out and explore what the Institute for Principled Policy is about, what the Institute on the Constitution classes we teach are about, and what Camp American is all about. So if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to go out there and you can send us an email. You can leave commentary on things we've written or previous shows. Again, we look forward to hearing from you, and we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.